Okay. There's no one to introduce me, which is no big loss, so I'm just going to go straight into things. So, actually, one of the first things I wanted to do was to thank Mr. Shiv Dasani for paying for this fellowship that has enabled me to spend this fantastic time having a very enjoyable stay in the centre here. And this is the last of my lectures at OCHS. I have one lecture next week in Jan Westerhoff's religion seminar on Thursday of next week. And this is the second of these two lectures with the title Indian Logic and the Existence of God. And today we're going to get the theist's response to the arguments we saw last time from the atheist. So let's just remind ourselves of what the inference was that the theist, who is a Nayayika, put forward for the existence of God. First premise, earth, etc., are effects. Second premise, whatever is an effect has a maker. And they yielded the conclusion that earth, etc., have a maker. Where the etc. is usually filled out with things like mountains, oceans. Now, we saw last time that this was met by the atheist with a heavy diss. The atheist claimed that the argument is unestablished, inconclusive, and contradictory. And Jayanta's response to each of these three is incredibly rich. And unfortunately, we're only going to have time to look at actually a fraction, really, of Jayanta's argumentation in response to all of these. We won't have any time to look at how he responds to this. I thought we'd look in quite a lot of detail at how he responds to the first one, so we can hopefully get clarity about that. But that means we'll only have a very short time at the end where I can give you a taste of how Jayanta responds to the second objection. But before looking at his specific points in regard to these three, we can observe that Jayanta's general strategy is to say that if those faults are true of the God inference, then they're also true of the fire inference. So Jayanta will throughout be arguing that the valid inference that everyone accepts as valid of fire from smoke is exactly parallel to the inference of God, so that if these faults apply to the God inference, they also apply to the fire inference, which would mean that all inference is invalid. And that's a conclusion that's not acceptable to either side of the debate. Well, in fact, it would be acceptable to one kind of atheist, the Charvakas. The Charvakas don't think that inference provides us with valid knowledge. They think only perception provides us with valid knowledge. But the idea that all inference is invalid would not be acceptable to the Nayayika, to the Buddhist, to the other atheists apart from the Buddhists, such as the Mimamsaka, the Jaina, the Samkhya. So, that's Jayanta's general strategy. Now let's focus in on his argument against the claim that the God inference is unestablished. Now, for those of you who like these tri-rupya diagrams, this is just to remind you of what it is for an inference to be unestablished. For an inference to be unestablished means that the hetu, the reason property, is not established in the subject, in Sanskrit, paksha. Now, in the God inference in particular, the hetu is being an effect. So if we have a cross in this box, it means the inference is unestablished, because that cross indicates that the hetu, being an effect, is absent from the subject. The subject in this God inference is earth, etc. For the property of being an effect to be absent from earth, etc., of course, just means that earth, etc., are not effects. So, If you don't like these triropia diagrams, you can forget everything I said in the last slide, and you just have to remember that for the God inference to be unestablished is to claim that Earth, etc. are not effects. Now, Jayanta responds to this by giving a few arguments to the effect that Earth, etc. are obviously effects. Jayanta gives a few arguments establishing that Earth, etc. are, in fact, effects. And then he bolsters his position further by saying, and even if you atheists still have a problem with the idea that Earth, etc. are effects, well, in that case, we theists will put forward a different hetu. We'll just use a different hetu, namely, having a configuration. What is it that, yeah, in Sanskrit, sannivesha, having a configuration or structure. What does it mean to have a configuration? It basically just means to have parts. Because as soon as anything consists of more than one atom, those parts will be arranged in a certain configuration, a certain structure. So to have a configuration basically just means to consist of more than one part. So it looks like this new hetu is going to be fairly solidly established. It looks like Earth, etc. will have a configuration because Earth and mountains and oceans consist of more than one atom. They have parts. It looks like it's going to be uncontroversial that they have a configuration. However, even here, the atheist will claim that this too is unestablished. So how is the atheist claiming that Earth, etc., do not have a configuration? Well, the atheist at this point draws on a distinction made by Dharmakirti. In this text that I'm summarizing, the Nyaya Manjari by Jayanta, written at the end of the 9th century in Kashmir, the atheist speaker is using primarily Mimamsaka arguments. The atheist speaker is using arguments primarily from Kumarila and Umbeka. But in this particular stage of the argumentation, the atheist appeals to Dharmakirti. And the distinction which Dharmakirti makes in exactly this context of considering the inference of God from the hetu of having a configuration. And Dharmakirti distinguishes two different kinds of configuration. I'm going to call them A configurations and N configurations, where A stands for artifact and N stands for naturally occurring phenomena. And Dharmakirti is claiming that although we use the one word configuration to apply to both of these, to do that is not actually to carve up nature at its joints. Because for Dharmakirti, these are two different things. So for Dharmakirti, if language accorded a bit more with the way things are, we'd actually have two different words for these two. And just to support the point that Dharmakirti has here a point, and he's not just coming up with some dodgy way of finding one more fault with the argument, we could note that this distinction is actually one that we tend to have and use quite spontaneously. If you're going for a walk in a deserted landscape where humans don't usually go, let's say a desert or a remote forest, if you suddenly saw a chair, you'd be slightly jolted and you'd think, oh, that configuration is a bit, the configuration of the chair is a bit different from the configuration of everything else around here. Or even if you don't consciously entertain that thought, you will think, oh, human beings have been here. So you will naturally distinguish that configuration that the chair has from the configuration of everything else around, and you'll infer that a human has been there. Whereas if the sand in the desert has been blown into a particular configuration, you wouldn't think, oh, a human has been here and done that. So we seem to make this distinction spontaneously, and we seem in the one case to infer the presence of an agent, but in the other not. Archaeologists use this distinction when they're sifting through their digs. They're trying to distinguish things they find that are just there naturally and things that are the product of human agency. When people are looking at ancient landscapes, if they find, say, an arrangement of stones in a perfect circle, they would probably think, okay, a human agent has done that. No one thinks that the stones of Stonehenge have that configuration just naturally. We assume that humans have done that. But other kinds of configuration, we don't make that inference. Actually, this came up sort of tangentially in the Unartman conference, in the talk by, he's a philosopher from Durham. I was wondering if he was your colleague, Jan, when you were there. He was called
Simon James?
Simon P. James, yeah. So he gave a talk on nature and Buddhism, and at the beginning of his talk, he felt he had to defend the category of nature as a distinct category against attacks from people like Bruno Latour, who have argued that actually there is no distinction between the natural and the human. And Simon P. James so came up with this definition of the natural as what is not human and what is not designed by humans. He felt that we do need to keep that as a separate category. Now, let's grant then that this is a valid distinction between these two kinds of configuration. That means then that the theist, or someone who wants to use this hetu as proof for the existence of God, will have to choose one of these two to serve as the hetu. So, what do you think? Which of these two will be a suitable hetu to prove a maker?
The first one.
Yeah, it's going to have to be an A configuration. So then the next question is that A configuration present in Earth, etc.? No. So therefore, this hetu is unestablished. The A configuration is unestablished in Earth, etc. So even this hetu having a configuration is unestablished. And we can easily extend this point, actually, to the other hetu being an effect. We just have to say that there are two kinds of effect, artifacts and naturally occurring effects. Which of these two kinds of effect is going to be a suitable hetu to prove a maker? It's clearly going to be artifact effects, but artifact effects are not present in Earth, etc. So therefore, by exactly this reasoning, being an effect is also going to come out as unestablished. So this is a new line of atheist argument that we didn't see last week. And before seeing how Jayanta responds to it, let's just consolidate our understanding of what the problem is here, what the purported problem is here. I think we could say that from the point of view of the atheist, we have in the God inference an extension problem and a problematic gap. What does that mean? Well, in the God inference, we're dealing with two samples. The first sample is things like pots, houses, cloths, i.e. artifacts. By observing all the things in that first sample, we observe that they all have the property of having a maker. The pot has a potter, the house has a builder, the cloths have a weaver. They all have this property of having a maker. And that property of having a maker then gets transferred in the argument to the second sample of earth, oceans, mountains, trees, etc., which we can call naturally occurring phenomena. Now, the reason that that extension of the property from the first sample to the second is problematic for the atheist is because the things in the first sample are a different kind of thing from the things in the second sample. Therefore, we're not justified in transferring the property from the first to the second. The fact that all of the former have makers doesn't lend any credence to the fact that the second have makers. Now, at this point, Dharmakirti gives this example. You observe many instances of white smoke to coexist with fire. You then see some white chalk dust, and you infer that that white chalk dust is on fire. So this is a clearly invalid inference. The white chalk dust is not on fire. But Dharmakirti is maintaining that exactly what's going wrong here goes wrong in the God inference. Could anyone think through why this is purportedly exactly parallel to the God inference? Just as in the God inference. Yeah, John, please.
I mean, I don't fully know, but it seems to me that Dharmakirti, just what you've put to us, is suggesting that white chalk dust is sort of not indicative of kind of causality. So it's like the second thing and not like the first thing.
White chalk dust is like which second thing?
Earth's oceans, mountains, and so on.
Right,
it's not,
exactly.
It's
so
not caused or agented, as it were.
Yeah, so we can kind of separate out in this inference, as in the first inference, two different samples and a property that's being transferred from the first sample to the second sample. What's the property that's being transferred in the case of the chalk dust? Yeah, exactly, being on fire. The property here is being on fire, and that being on fire has been observed in the first sample, means in the cases of white smoke, and then in the new sample, namely the chalk dust, which as John said is parallel to the second sample, you transfer that property of being on fire from the previous instances of white smoke to the white chalk dust. Why do you do that? Because you form the mistaken belief that all white objects coexist with fire. Just as, according to the atheist, in the God inference, you formed the incorrect belief that all effects, or all things that have a configuration, have a maker. Whereas, in fact, only one subset of those have a maker, namely artifacts. Similarly, only one subset of white things is on fire, namely white smoke. So there's something a bit artificial about this, in that this relies on the fact that all of the white things you've ever seen in your life have only been smoke. This relies on you never having seen any white thing other than smoke before you encounter the white chalk dust. So maybe to avoid that slight awkwardness, or maybe for some other reason, Dharmakirti then gives another parallel example. You observe many instances of clay jars and dishes to be produced by a potter. You then see a clay termite hill, and you infer that the clay termite hill was produced by a potter. Can people see how that is purportedly similar? In this case too, let's separate out what the first sample would be, what the second sample would be, and what the property is that's being transferred. What's the property that's being transferred in this case? Being produced by a potter, exactly. And what's the first sample?
Clay jars and dishes.
Yeah, let's say clay artifacts, yeah. Exactly. And the second sample is then this clay termite hill, or we could say all clay objects that are not artifacts. And this property that you've observed being produced by a potter in the first sample in clay artifacts, you're illegitimately transferring to the clay termite hill, because you've formed the incorrect assumption that all clay objects are produced by a potter, whereas in fact only one subgroup of clay objects is produced by a potter, namely clay artifacts. Now, what is it that enables this extension? This extension of the property from one sample to another. this extension, which is looking dodgy, at least in these two cases. Well, it looks like it's enabled by having a heitu, a reason property, with a very wide scope. So the heitu in this case would be all, well, it would be whiteness, the property of having whiteness. That's a very wide, that's a property with a very wide scope, meaning it's instantiated in a very large heterogeneous group. Similarly, the property of being clay, that has a wide scope. It's instantiated not only in clay artifacts, but also clay things that are not produced by humans. That covers a heterogeneous group. And it looks like this is what the problem is. And so purports, so the atheist is claiming that in the God inference, the heitu has too wide a scope. The heitu being an effect or having a configuration covers a heterogeneous group comprising distinct subgroups, effects which are artifacts and effects which are naturally occurring phenomena, and what's true of the first is not necessarily true of what's not necessarily true of the second. So now, what's the theist's response to this? Well, Jayanta, when he's writing in the voice of the theist, claims that actually all of this is exactly parallel to the valid inference of smoke from fire. Jayanta will claim that even in the valid inference, sorry, of fire from smoke, even in that valid case, Jayanta will claim we have extension, we have a gap, and we have a heterogeneous group. Can anyone imagine how Jayanta will argue this? How could Jayanta say that in the valid inference of fire, there's a gap between samples and there's extension of a property over that gap?
Different types of fire? Or different types of smoke, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And what's the property that's being transferred from one kind of smoke to another kind of smoke?
Being smoke?
No.
Oh, being produced.
Exactly. That's exactly it. So, Jayanta argues that the smoke you see on the mountain does not have precisely the same size, shape, and density as all the previous smokes you've seen. The kitchen is mentioned, of course, because we're dealing with the time before electric and gas stoves, when people would cook their food in the kitchen over a wood fire. And so the kitchen is the place where you've been exposed to more smokes and fires than anywhere else. And Jayanta's point is that when you see the smoke on the mountain, it will be slightly different in its size, shape, and density than any smoke you've seen before in the kitchen or in your neighbourhood. And Jayanta at this point goes into verse. Jayanta is a very beautiful writer of Sanskrit. He was also a poet. He wrote plays as well as philosophy. He spontaneously goes into verse in his philosophical texts, as does, for example, Pragyakaragupta and Kumarila. It was Kumarila who started this trend. And at this point, Jayanta goes into verse and gives this very flowery sentence about how there's a contrast between the smoke in the kitchen with its small size, thin shape, the fact that it's produced by a very weak fire, and the fact that it's inflamed by a gentle blowing on the part of the cook. Contrast that with the dense fire, the dense smoke on the mountain arising from a thick forest, inflamed by a massive gust of wind and pervading the whole sky. So, Jayanta's point is that the heitu in the fire inference, namely being smoky, is also very wide in its scope and covers a heterogeneous group, is instantiated in a heterogeneous group. Now, for the next part, forgive me, I'm just going to read out some paragraphs. So, Jayanta, writing in the voice of the theist, argues that if the kind of configuration in an artifact is different from the kind of configuration in a naturally occurring phenomenon, well, so too, the kind of smoke in the kitchen is different from the kind of smoke on the mountain. If what is true of a certain kind of configuration, i.e. that it has a maker, cannot be inferred to be true of another kind of configuration, then what is true of a certain kind of smoke, i.e. that it has been caused by fire, should not be inferred to be true of another kind of smoke. So if we've never seen a mass of dense and copious smoke before, and hence never observed the association of that kind of smoke with fire, we would not be able to infer that some dense and copious smoke on the mountain is caused by fire, however many smoky kitchen fires we have observed. Thus, all inference would be undermined. If even the fire inference is not valid, then no inference will be valid, since the fire inference is the very paradigm of inference which all inferences are supposed to correspond to. So, what to make of this? Jayanta has laid down a challenge. How could we distinguish these two inferences, the God inference from the fire inference? Well, the Buddhist will say, in the fire instance, fire inference, there is no gap and no extension over a gap. Smoke's pervasion by fire. Yeah, this word pervasion in Sanskrit, vyapti, I think I only used it once last week and I only explained it quite briefly. For smoke to be pervaded by fire means that in this Venn diagram, the domain that consists of all instances of fire pervades, i.e. completely covers, the domain of all smokes. We can have fire without smoke. When the wood is very dry, you'll have fire without any smoke, but you can never have smoke without fire, which means smoke is pervaded by fire. And for an inference to be valid, the hetu must always be pervaded by the sadhya, so that you know that wherever the hetu occurs, the sadhya occurs. So in the fire inference, there is no gap. This is the Buddhist talking. And no extension over a gap. Smoke's pervasion by fire has been established through the observation of repeated fires in the kitchen. The established pervasion is not between smoke of a certain kind and fire. It's between smoke in general and fire in general. So here the Buddhist is maintaining the contrast between the two inferences and claiming that in the God inference, the pervasion is just between being an effect of a certain kind and having a maker, whereas in the fire inference, the pervasion is between smoke in general and fire in general. Jayanta will reply, the established pervasion in the God inference is between being an effect in general and having a maker in general. It's not between a certain kind of effect and a certain kind of maker. So there is no gap here either. The Buddhist will say, but in the God inference, the pervasion has only been established between artifacts and makers, not between naturally occurring phenomena and makers. Jayanta will reply, some extension is involved in all inferences. Yes, these supposedly naturally occurring phenomena like earth and mountains were not included in the original sample set, but neither was the mountain with its huge dense smoke included in the original sample set. So Jayanta is claiming there's no disanalogy between the two inferences. For Jayanta, in the fire inference too, there is a kind of gap in that the smokes in the kitchen are different from the smoke on the mountain. The smoke on the mountain was not included in the original sample set. Well, the Buddhist might say, if we compare the set of all smokes to the set of all effects or configurations, there's more heterogeneity in the latter class. The Buddhist will assert that surely the set of all smokes is less heterogeneous than the set of all causes and all configurations. So therefore, it's much less of a jump to go from the small kitchen smoke to the large mountain smoke than it is to go from an artifact such as a pot to earth or the ocean. Jayanta will reply, heterogeneity is always inevitable. It is there even in inferences that the Buddhist takes to be valid. The Buddhists distinguish two kinds of configuration, A configurations and N configurations, it being valid to infer a maker only of and from A configurations. So the Buddhist does accept that it is valid to infer a maker whenever we encounter an A configuration. But Jayanta points out that even A configurations are radically heterogeneous. The configurations of a piece of cloth, which is flat and two-dimensional, a pot, a palace, are all very different. To that we could add a camera, a television, an iPod. If we know that cameras and televisions have a maker, and we see an iPod for the first time after iPods have been invented, we may, on seeing that iPod, infer that it has a maker. The Buddhist can and will allow that. But if the Buddhist allows that, then they accept that we can have a valid inference despite a gap between the sample set and the proof subject, and despite a wide hetu, a wide reason property, that's instantiated in a diverse, heterogeneous group of things. So what to do? We seem to have reached a stalemate. How could we decide between these two? Well, I think the issue that separates the two can be stated in just one sentence. The issue here is how similar to naturally occurring phenomena and artifacts need to be for us to infer that they have the same kind of cause. And this was exactly the issue that David Hume identified as at the heart of the argument from design. And Hume's verdict was that the matter is undecidable. And I will end this section with some perceptive contrasts that John Tabor has identified between Hume's treatment of the argument from design and the Indian treatment of the argument from having a configuration. Yeah, so we've been looking at two different hetus, having an effect, being an effect and having a configuration. Being an effect is often compared to the European cosmological argument for God's existence, and the Indian argument from having a configuration is often compared to the European argument from design. So Hume deals with the argument from design, so it's sort of natural to compare Hume's treatment of that with this argument from having a configuration. The arguments are very similar. Hume spotted several of the same defects as Jayanta's atheist opponent did last time. For Hume, there is too little similarity between artifacts and naturally occurring phenomena, or as Hume puts it, between a watch and the universe, to infer a cause of the universe that has significant resemblance to the cause of a watch. So Hume's point is that a watch and the universe are not similar enough for us to infer a cause of the universe that closely resembles the cause of a watch. To state this in Indian terminology, the hetu having a configuration is too broad. It covers a heterogeneity. The configuration of artifacts is something different from the configuration of naturally occurring phenomena, so we cannot infer that the latter have a maker like the former do. But, although Hume was a stern critic of the argument from design, his position was not that it is fallacious, but rather that it is merely probable. So Hume thought that the strongest conclusion one can draw from the argument from design is that the cause or causes of order in the universe probably bear some remote analogy to human intelligence. Tabor identifies respective advantages of the Indian and the Humean treatments of the argument. So Tabor thinks that the more technical, logical framework of the Indian analysis of the argument enables a more efficient and precise formulation of its strengths and weaknesses. And he thinks that this more formal Indian approach also allows us to see that the criticisms of the argument potentially affect all inference. Hume's more informal approach, on the other hand, is more suited to revealing that the debate is irresolvable. The issue is whether watches, pots, i.e. artifacts, and mountains and earth all belong to the same class with respect to the kind of configuration they exhibit. So the issue is whether the configuration of artifacts is similar enough to the configuration of naturally occurring phenomena for them to belong to the same class. But as Hume shows, this is not a formal technical matter. It's a question of judgment. Jayanta can endlessly point out the similarities between pots and mountains and the necessity of there always being some heterogeneity and some extension, otherwise all inference becomes impossible. The atheist can stress the differences. Earth and mountains are only vaguely similar to pots, the atheist will claim, not similar enough to imply that they too have a maker. But how similar do things have to be for them to be counted as members of the same class? How different do they have to be to fall into separate classes? There is no objective answer. And Tabor's claim is that the Indian preoccupation with the identification of technical fallacies and ways of avoiding them blocked realization of this fact. So this is Tabor's point, which I think has something to recommend it, namely that Hume was right, that this is really the strongest conclusion that we can get from the argument, but at the same time, the argument is not a fallacy. So I think we can reject this black and white assumption that was an assumption shared by the Indian participants in this debate, that the inference must either be fallacious or it must conclusively prove God's existence. And rather see that the argument implies a certain kind of probability that the cause of the universe is in some way analogous to human intelligence without conclusively proving that naturally occurring effects have a maker. Now, I'm just going to spend the last 5 minutes giving you a taste of how Jayanta deals with the second charge, that the inference is inconclusive. What does it mean for an inference to be inconclusive? It means that the hetu, the reason property, exists not only with the sadhya, but also sometimes without the sadhya. The reason property exists not only with the property to be proved, but sometimes also with the absence of the property to be proved. So that's why for an inference to be inconclusive, we must have a tick here and a tick here. The tick here, to talk now specifically about the God inference, indicates that the hetu, being in effect, is present. So that means being in effect does occur with the property to be proved, possessing a maker, but it also occurs in the absence of the property to be proved. And since being in effect occurs not only with possession of a maker, but also without possession of a maker, that means being in effect is not conclusive evidence for possession of a maker. It's inconclusive, because it sometimes occurs with a maker and sometimes without a maker. So that's what it is for an inference to be inconclusive. You have the hereto present not only in the similar cases, but in the dissimilar cases. Whereas for the argument to be conclusive and valid, we need a cross in the bottom right. Now this diagram just simply replicates exactly the diagram that was on the previous slide. And this is the claim of the atheist, that the argument is inconclusive. Jayanta, the theist, is claiming, no, the God inference is conclusive. So Jayanta's claiming that there's a cross here. Can anyone see how Jayanta could claim that there is a cross here? So the cross means that being in effect is absent. So Jayanta will claim that being in effect, that property, does not occur along with the property of lacking a maker, does not occur in things that lack a maker. Why, can anyone remember from last time, how did the atheist argue that we have a tick there? How did what example did the atheist use to illustrate the fact that some effects lack a maker? Yeah. The atheist gave this example of some wild, uncultivated grass. That's an effect, but it doesn't have a maker, just grows spontaneously. So that example of wild grass illustrates that something can be an effect and yet not have a maker. Since it doesn't have a maker, it's an example of a dissimilar case, and yet it is an effect, so we have a tick there. So the presence of wild grass there explains why the atheist thinks that we have the presence of being in effect there, because wild grass is an effect. Now that means that if Jayanta is going to claim that this is the situation, he's not going to be able to have wild grass going in there. So where will Jayanta argue that wild grass occurs? Because remember that these big rectangles represent the whole universe. Everything in the universe has to fit in one of these three categories. So wild grass is going to have to go somewhere, and it's not going to be able to go in the dissimilar cases. Yeah.
I mean, he's not going to argue that it's not an effect, so he's going to argue it has a maker.
So,
I hope
the theist may try and do that, but actually that will not be allowed.
Okay.
Because there's a rule in these debates that for anything to count as a similar case or a dissimilar case, it must be agreed to by both sides of the debate. So the theist can't just specify at the outset of the argument that wild grass has a maker. That would be to assume at the outset that wild grass has as its maker God, i.e. that God exists. Remember that when the theist claims that wild grass has a maker, that means that God is the maker of wild grass. Well, if the inference is successful, and the theist does successfully prove that God exists, well then at that point we will know that wild grass has God as its maker. But we can't assume that until after the inference is complete, so we can't just put wild grass in here. Yeah. So that would be a fallacy. That would be to assume the conclusion before we've reached the conclusion. So what is left for where wild grass could go? Yeah. So now we can see why, throughout this whole discussion, we've had this etc. So the etc is going to include not just mountains and oceans, but also wild grass, and what else is going to have to be covered by the etc. Exactly. Everything that's naturally occurring is going to be taken out of the dissimilar cases and put in the paksha. So that means that any possible counterexample, any possible example that looks like it's going to show that something can be an effect without a maker, is going to be put into the paksha, into the subject. This is quite an interesting move, and it's actually very difficult to see why it shouldn't be allowed. It's actually very difficult to establish that this is an illegitimate move. But that is the way that Nyayikas, who infer the existence of God, operate from around Jayanta's time onwards. Vachaspati Mishra does this, and then Udayana and the Navya Nyayikas. They basically divide everything in the universe into three. There's things that we can all agree, the atheist and the theist, have a maker. Artifacts. They go in the similar cases. And they are, of course, effects. So we have a tick there. In the dissimilar cases, we put everything that both sides agree to lack a maker. So atoms, space, time, souls, atmans. These, in the Indian context, were thought not to be created by God, but to be eternal. So they lack a maker. But none of those are effects. They're all eternal. So that means we don't have the presence of the hetu there, so we have a cross there, and everything else, all naturally occurring phenomena, goes into the subject. The etc. indicates the presence of all naturally occurring phenomena. So the first premise becomes all naturally occurring phenomena are an effect. That's true. No problem with that. Then we have to establish whether the second premise is true. Whatever is an effect has a maker. Well, to establish whether that's true, you just have to investigate the similar cases and the dissimilar cases, and there are now no counterexamples. There's now nothing left that is an effect but lacks a maker. So then you carry out the inference, and the conclusion validly follows that Earth, etc., have a maker. Yeah.
I mean, I'm happy with that, excepting that I don't see the difference between putting it into the paksha and just saying that it's a sub-paksha.
Well, it's just that there's this principle which has been written about by people like Charles Goodman and actually someone who I think has been a fellow here in the past, K.K. Chakrabarty, Kishore Chakrabarty, in his book on Nyaya. He identifies this principle that governs these debates, for which he uses the acronym G-A-I-E. The general acceptability of inductive examples. And this was a principle that was adhered to in these debates between the philosophical schools, that one side can't just put something into the sapaksha, into the similar cases, that the other side of the debate will disagree about. So the reason for that is you shouldn't be able to, at the outset of the argument, assume that God doesn't exist, because that's what's in question. The question is whether God exists or not, and we arrive at an answer to that through the process of the inference. So you shouldn't be able to assume at the outset of the inference that wild grass lacks a maker, because if God does exist, then God is the maker of the wild grass.
So it has to go into the paksha because it is precisely what's under question.
Yes, exactly. So the the paksha contains the things about which there's some doubt. The reason that the mountain is in the paksha is because there's some doubt about whether there's fire on the mountain or not. You can't see the fire on the mountain, you have some doubt. So therefore, you carry out the inference, and then at the end of the inference, you know there's fire.
So, I'm sorry, but
For
the Nyayika to put the wild grass into the similar case is as much of an assumption as for the atheist to put it into the dissimilar case.
No, it's not actually. Okay. Because both sides actually agree that I think what you said was right actually. Sorry.
To put wild grass into a dissimilar case is as much an assumption as to put it into the similar
exactly,
place.
Exactly right, yeah. Yeah.
So neither side can make that move,
yeah.
Therefore they push it into the
exactly.
category of what is under debate.
What is under debate, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's really actually quite brilliant.
Yeah, so the, as I said, the Perkshire is what there's some doubt about, and it would be a bit strange in the smoke-fire inference if someone were to say, well, no, it's not the case that smoke always occurs with fire, because look, on the mountain there's some smoke and we can't see fire. So it's illegitimate to point to the Perkshire as a counterexample to the pervasion of Hetu and Sadhya. You wouldn't point to the mountain and say, oh look, there's some smoke without fire, because that's exactly what's in doubt, and that's what would be established by the inference.